Stuff or? Okay.
How's life?
I'd like to call to order the House Education Committee for December 12, 2016.
We're in class.
Yes, right.
Hey, we have kind of a long agenda, so we want to get going on this, but I'd like to welcome you all back, and hopefully you all have a good holiday. And I was going to introduce our committee administrator, Richard Donovan, but he's not there. He's back there, so we don't have to do that. Thank you. I told him I was going to embarrass him, so that's what it is. Okay, we are here for an informational meeting. We welcome you all back. And so the first informational meeting we will have, or informational hearing, is on the update from the Chief Executive Education Officer, the Office of the Governor, Mr. Capps. And does Colt Gill want to come up with you?
Yeah,
thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lindsay Capps. I'm the Chief Education Officer, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you on two important efforts we're spearheading through the Chief Education Office, building on two priorities that were laid out by Governor Brown in 2016 and now reflected in her recommended budget and legislation the Chief Education Office will be bringing forward in 2017. I think, as you all know, the governor has made clear her priority to ensure more Oregon students graduate high school, especially our low-income and traditionally underserved students. In 2016, the governor established the position of Education Innovation Officer within the Chief Education Office to put a spotlight on strategies, programs, and practices to improve our state's graduation outcomes. A critical charge of the Education Innovation Officer is in this process is to convene and work with communities and schools to identify and scale up practices that ensure more Oregon students graduate high school with a plan for their future, and to work with myself and Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor in making recommendations to the governor and legislature on policy and budget priorities aligned to what is working for students in our communities. The governor also made clear her commitment to invest in excellent teaching and charged the Council on Educator Advancement, which she established by executive order, to make recommendations on better supporting the education workforce and our early learning and K-12 systems. And I'm here to provide a brief overview of the Council's findings. But if it's okay with the chair, I'd like to begin by introducing Oregon's Education Innovation Officer, Colt Gill, which many of you know. Appointed by the governor, Colt assumed this position last July, having an extensive career in public education as a teacher, technology leader, and school superintendent in the Bethel School District, and someone who has engaged students and parents in that community, as well as partners across the education system from early learning to higher ed, to help students transition successfully across the learning continuum and create pathways of success for every student, always with the foundation in equity. I'd like to turn it over to Colt to discuss his engagement with the communities across the state. There's been a lot since July, I can tell you, and talk a little bit about some of the themes that are emerging as these conversations have gone forward with students, parents, and educators across the state. Colt.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks. Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to begin this conversation about our efforts to improve graduation outcomes for our students here in Oregon. For the record, my name is Colt Gill, and the Education Innovation Officer. Governor Brown is prioritizing graduation improvements by setting a vision that every student graduate with a plan for their future. We have a long way to go. After spending 13 years in our schools from kindergarten to 12th grade, 26% of our students are not able to graduate on time. Oregon is the third worst performing state in the nation on that metric and is about 9 points off the national average. In 2015, our poor performance with on-time graduation meant that 11,826 of our students were not able to graduate on time. So these rates are disproportionate to our overall population. They impact mostly our students with disabilities, our students living in tribal communities, our students of color, our students navigating poverty, and our boys. Governor Brown was clear when she received this information that our graduation rate is unacceptable and not in keeping with the gains made by other states. So to ensure better future for our children and our state, we must change our practices. We must find a way to innovate. In my new role as the Education Innovation Officer within the Chief Education Office, I work across preschool to higher education systems and focus on improving graduation outcomes. I'll be coordinating closely with the Chief Education Officer and Deputy Superintendent to guide the Governor's priorities and implementation strategies related to graduation. I have been and will continue, and I'll share a little bit about this, but will continue to engage with schools and communities and researchers to try to identify what's working and consider how we can take successful practices and partnerships and promote them across all corners of the state. I'll recommend policy, budget priorities, and actions to improve graduation rates and ensure that students have meaningful future opportunities. And I'll consider how promising practices can translate into actions to improve graduation and policy that can be implemented into practice at schools. This summer and fall, I worked with a researcher to hear directly from diverse communities across Oregon. We asked them what was derailing their children on their path to graduation and what local programs they thought were making a difference for their children. We were able to talk with students, families, business leaders, community partners, healthcare providers, housing providers, tribal leaders, educators, and many other kinds of folks. In all, we were able to meet face-to-face with about 1,000 individuals representing dozens of communities across 32 counties. The meetings were very real. They were places where people were very open and honest. There were a lot of laughs at times. There was a lot of pride shared in place and in programs that folks had in place. There were tears over students who were being lost in our systems and in our communities. Across the state, there was great alignment in what communities recommended we focus on, and there was great diversity in describing how initiatives should be implemented differently across different communities in our state. Participants coalesced around a strong emphasis on equity, recognizing that Oregon is changing and our systems of support have not kept up with our rapidly diversifying communities. They also focused on making time for developing relationships between caring adults and students and demonstrating relevance of programs to students and local goals and infrastructure. Participants got specific as well. They did end up identifying about 10 different initiatives that they thought could make a difference to students and the trajectory towards graduation, improving graduation outcomes. So what I hope to do is come back to you as the session begins and deliver the full report. It has many quotes from participants across Oregon, as well as some recommendations on how we can begin to implement some of what these Oregonians believe can change the game for our children. So again, thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit this morning.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions, comments? Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been talking with a lot of kids and parents as well for quite some time. I find myself coming at it in a different way, and that is the kids are identified as deficits. I would like, if you can, to find a way to make sure that that's not the case. When I have a fifth grader tell me that he's an at-risk student, yep, pretty much drives me nuts. Because he's not. Our system is at risk, but he's not. So I would ask that you begin to look at the philosophy that identifies kids as what they need, not that they are the problem. Mm-hmm. That's all that I ask.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. Any other questions, comments? Representative McLean.
One of the comments that you made that I thought was interesting and important was that you were asking folks, you know, basically what were some of the barriers, mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. And it seems really important for us to talk about barriers and to talk about what those barriers are during a certain or a particular time frame. Because over the time of my teaching, which was over 42 years, there was a different budget. there was a difference in support. Mm-hmm. There was a difference in the kinds of classes that we could offer because we had the budget to do it. There was a difference in attitude about college versus career and apprenticeship programs. And so it can't just be in a silo that we need to look at the barriers, but look at them at what time frame and when they were talking about them and when certain things became an issue. Because if we're trying to rectify or if we're trying to respond to, we have to understand what the conditions were during those times. And that will help us in the solution and being able to identify and also to analyze the suggestions that you bring.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a question in this, truly. So as I hear your testimony and the good work that you've been out doing and the conversations you've been having and the listening that you're doing, it is great information. And I value the time and the resources that you and those that have chosen to show up and share thoughts, their time also. What I haven't heard yet is what's different. In 9 years, I've heard lots of testimony and seen lots of studies and lots of things that say we're not doing well here. And we need to do this. And so we create a different program, another program, we change a program. And we're in, I think, about the same spot. So I'm trying to hear what's different this time.
So Representative Springer, Chair Daugherty, I think that when I'm able to share the full report with you, you will see some of the initiatives that are a little bit different than what we've put forward in the past in some ways. So the strong focus on equity will be very clear. That came up at every meeting that we had. The idea that it is our system that's failing students and not our students that are failing came up over and over again. A strong emphasis on regionalized programs and community partnerships, where schools and community partners come together to serve students so that those relationships can be built and be strong between students and caring adults, is a strong focus throughout as well. And then a number of specific initiatives that some of them I think that we have called for in Oregon and haven't been able to implement in the past, and some are new kinds of programs. So I'm anxious to share, but I think that's for the future.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, you said you'd gone out to the different areas and talked with people in Oregon, but I'm wondering about looking at other states' national models and taking best practices from them and saying, you know, what works in those states, and just taking the stuff that works in those states and say, can we implement it here?
Mr. Luna from Washington.
Yeah, Representative Barreto, Chair Daugherty. So we are, one of the other parts of my job is to look at research and national research and practices. I think that one of the things we will find is that we can pretty readily identify what works for students. It is similar to what Representative Springer said. We've identified some of those pieces in the past, and the next step is how do we implement them in Oregon, in a state with very diverse communities of different sizes with different community makeup. How do we roll that out so that each community can own it and feel like this is something that they can make work within their school system and within their community? So what was identified by Oregonians in many cases matched the national research on what is identified as a best practice. So the idea now is to put those things together and say, we know this works from other places and some places in Oregon, and we know that there are communities asking for it. So how do we provide the right kind of support so that they can implement it in the unique way that their community needs?
Mm-hmm. And so funny you should mention, we are stealing something from the state of Washington that they've had for about 4 or 5 years, and you'll be hearing
legal
about that later.
It's legal to steal, though, from state to state.
Yes, we're borrowing.
Yeah, can I ask another question?
Please, quickly.
One of the things that you talk to superintendents around the state is always comes up is the family. you know, and without the family, without that core foundation, you know, it's not the school's responsibility to raise the kids, it's their responsibility to teach the kids. And so if we have this situation with the family that affects education from there on up, are we doing anything, you know, besides Head Start, you know, to work with those families in developing parenting skills, follow through, whatever it is, to help them help you to have a better outcome?
Yes, so Representative Barato, Chair Doherty, we have, this came up many, many times. So when I talked to across the state, when we were able to talk to K-12 educators, most of our conversations were very student-centric. K-12 educators work with students directly all day, every day. They care a lot about student success. So that's where the focus of the conversations were. When I talked to students themselves or their family members or community partner organizations, or early learning partners and healthcare partners, all of those conversations focused on families and students, and usually in that order. So if you want to serve the student, you need to serve the family and make sure that they're prepared to support their child through their education. In the recommendations that we'll put forward, you'll see a strong emphasis on a combined support for families and students, and we've even named each of the categories: family and student preparedness, family and student supports, family and students pathways. So I think we're gonna have a strong shift to trying to support the entire family.
Thank you. Representative Springer, and then we're gonna have to move on. Representative Hack.
Representative Springer, first. Thank you, Madam Chair. You don't even need to respond to this. It's just kind of a question I'm just putting out there because I've been wrestling with it. And please don't respond, because she'll give me the hook.
No.
What if, and I've just been stewing on this for a few months now, what if for 1 year we changed nothing? Mm-hmm. We did nothing, and we just took our hands off. And then we would maybe have the opportunity to see if something works. Because what I've seen over and over and over is we do it, doesn't feel like it's working right away, so we do something else. Don't respond. Oh, sorry, Lindsay. Whatever. She's the chair. I'm not the chair. What if we just took our hands off for a little bit?
And we didn't even talk. Okay. Would you like to respond, or would you just...
Totally up to her now.
You do not have to if you don't
Chair
want
Doherty,
to.
Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, I'll honor the wishes of the committee. We'll be back, I think, for conversation during the session, and I think that's a great question
don't
for
do
us
anything.
To address. But.
Okay, Representative Hack. Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as it relates to teachers, teacher burnout, lack of teacher staying, average we hear is 3 to 5 years, and then they move on. Are you addressing, or do you plan to address, that piece of the issue with all of this? Because not having the continuity of teachers and this constant turnover and burnout is of great concern also.
So Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, I was prepared to give a little bit of an update on the Council for Educator Advancement, which is focused, I think, on your point, which is the strategies to support students need to be aligned with excellent teaching in our schools, and culturally responsive and equity-driven mm-hmm. teaching and learning. So I'm happy to talk a little bit about that today, or in the interest of time, I'd be happy to come back.
I
think we see that work very much aligned with
because I think this is something that's almost, you know, much more of a discussion than what we have here. I really do. So okay, is that everybody? Representative Frederick?
No.
Okay, and the only thing I have is that this is saying, they always talk about graduation rates, you know, we have 26% and so on and so forth, in 4 years. And I think my question is, because I know in my local school district, we bring them back. Mm-hmm. And so they may be out in 5 or 5.5. And this is when we say we stole or borrowed something from the state of Washington, that's what we borrowed. And so I just wondered whether there are statistics that on, you know, If it was in 5 years, what would the rate be, and so on and so forth. So I think as an information piece down the road, when we talk about this quite a bit, I think it would be good. So, okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And Colt, welcome.
Thank you.
So I worked in Bethel for about 6 or 7 years with the classified. So yes. So I know the district well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, next we have a presentation on ESSA, Every Student Succeeds, and what legislators need to know. Sarah Shelton and Sharmila Mann, and this is from the Education Commission of the States. Welcome to Oregon. And even though we do have kind of timelines on the side, we'll honor you guys.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Shelton, and I'm a state relations, part of the state relations team at the Education Commission of the States, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk with you about ESSA and increased flexibility. And before I turn it over to my wonderful colleague, Sharmila Mann, I want to talk briefly about ECS, about who we are, what we do, and how we do it. So, Sharmila, if you don't mind advancing the slide. I'll get started. So who we are. ECS is the essential, indispensable member of any team addressing state education policy. We're nonpartisan, and we serve all education leaders in all 50 states. So this includes legislatures, governor's offices, state departments of education, state departments of higher education, and state school board members. And what do? So we believe in the power of learning from experience, and we know that informed policymakers create better education policy. So we serve as a partner to state policymakers, providing nonpartisan, unbiased advice and opportunities to come together with colleagues in other states. And how do we do this? Well, we divide our work into four buckets: research, report, counsel, and convene. So research, we compile summaries in 50 state databases on education policies ranging from early childhood to post-secondary education so that policymakers can make informed decisions. And last year alone, we answered over 600 personalized information requests. And typically, we're able to turn these around in about 24 hours. Reports, we regularly issue relevant and timely reports to education leaders with concise factual overviews on the full spectrum of state education policies. And I know you received an advanced copy of our ESSA quick guides on top issues as an example of one of those reports. And in 2016, we released over 55 reports and databases. We also counsel. We provide unbiased advice on policy plans. We consult on proposed legislation, and we testify at legislative hearings as third-party experts, as we're doing today. And we typically have at least one ECS staff member in the states every week working with policymakers. And then finally, we convene. We create opportunities for education leaders to really interact, to collaborate, and learn from one another, not only within states, but also across states. And we do this through our policy academies, thinkers meetings, and our national forum. So back at our office, we have 47 individuals at ECS are here to serve you, the people behind the policy. And we have really smart, talented researchers and policy analysts who follow legislation on a daily basis and read every bill and every word of every bill, including omnibus bills. So please reach out to us and let us know how we can support you. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my wonderful colleague, Sharmila Mann. She directs our K-12 Institute and is going to talk to you about ESSA. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Madam Chair, members of the committee. I wanted to talk to you folks specifically about the flexibility provision.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, please. Thank you very much.
My name is Sharmila Mann, and I am the director of the K-12 Institute at the Education Commission of the States.
Very much.
I wanted to speak with the committee today specifically about how the new reauthorization of ESEA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, is different from the previous reauthorization and how that provides some flexibility, increased flexibility to the states. So the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was first passed in 1965, emphasizing a civil rights initiative that all children should have equal access to education. It was last reauthorized in 2001 as No Child Left Behind, or NCLB, and NCLB had many prescriptive federal requirements. One of the hallmarks of the Every Student Succeeds Act, which was the reauthorization from 2015, is that many of those federal prescriptive requirements have been removed, and that the states had the authority to to provide the appropriate educational interventions for children has been shifted greatly to the states. The state has the authority over standards, assessments, and accountability systems. Along with that authority comes the responsibility for enforcing those requirements. And there are some federal guide rails that remain. So I wanted to set up this entire conversation around what remains the same between NCLB and ESSA and what has changed. So I'm going to talk specifically in three areas: standards and assessments, accountability, and funding, because those are the three areas where there is the greatest increase in flexibility for states. Around standards and assessment, what's the same is that states are still required to create academically challenging standards and assessments that are aligned to those standards. Annual assessments are maintained in grades 3 through 8 and in high school. In accountability, student achievement still needs to be reported out by subgroup, and schools and districts are held accountable for subgroup performance. In funding, the funding still flows from the Department of Education to the states, to the districts, and then to schools. And the major formulas of ESEA, as in the title programs, have been retained. However, several things have changed. In standards and assessments, and I will talk more deeply about these changes in a moment, I just wanted to give an overview first. In standards and assessment, there's increased state flexibility around assessment systems, and there's much more limited authority for the Secretary of Education around standards and assessments. In accountability, there's increased state flexibility to design accountability systems, interventions, and student supports. And there are a lot of concepts that were outdated, such as annual yearly progress, AYP, highly qualified teachers, HQT, that have been removed. In funding, there's increased state and local flexibility in the use of federal funds, and I will talk more about that in a moment. Also, several of the smaller programs in Title IV have been consolidated into a larger block grant. As I talk through these three different areas, in standards and assessments, I want to address standards and assessments separately from each other. In accountability, I'll be talking about the flexibility in measurement, which is around indicators and the rating system, flexibility in reporting, which is around the report cards, and flexibility in interventions, which is around the school support and improvement models. In funding, I specifically want to highlight supplement, not supplant, and school-based budgeting, which have been the two areas of greatest confusion and also some increased areas of flexibility. So beginning with standards, when I say states must, that is the part that is retained from NCLB, and in the section that I have labeled flexibility is the part that has changed under ESSA and provides additional flexibility to the states. So, as I mentioned before, states must adopt challenging academic standards, and they must ensure that those standards are aligned with college and career readiness. However, there is a lot of flexibility around setting standards. The state has complete authority to set their own standards. The secretary may not prescribe specific standards. The secretary may also not provide incentives either for or against certain standards. And finally, the Secretary of Education may not require states to submit their standards for approval by the Department of Education. So all of this is, these are things that were there in NCLB but were not clearly spelled out, and now it's clearly spelled out that the secretary may not do these things. In the alignment with the college and career readiness standards, the state has the authority to define their college and career readiness benchmark and also how their standards align with that benchmark. In assessments, states must continue to implement annual assessments in English and math in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, in science at least once in each grade span, and the states must ensure that assessments measure higher order thinking skills. there's a 95% participation requirement for assessments in that states must ensure that districts and schools annually test no less than 95% of students overall and within each subgroup, and that there is some sort of a method in the state accountability system to account for that participation rate in rating their districts and schools. And states must disaggregate data by subgroups, and this goes back to the civil rights principles of the Act. However, there is a lot of flexibility. The four main pieces of flexibility around assessment are around high school assessments, interim assessments, computer adaptive assessments, and assessment audits. I will talk about each in turn. In the high school assessment, states are now able to allow districts to choose a locally selected, nationally recognized high school assessment in lieu of the statewide assessment that is otherwise chosen. In the past, states were able to select a nationally recognized high school assessment for their accountability system, but it had to be implemented statewide. Now, districts can choose their own nationally recognized assessment, and different districts can have different assessments if the state approves those assessments as substantially able to be comparative to the state assessment. In the past, summative assessments needed to be used every year to provide accountability information. Now states have the option to take interim assessments over the course of the year and roll them up into a summative score that is used as the summative accountability measure. Computer adaptive assessments, there have been a lot of questions around that. ESSA specifically explicitly allows computer adaptive assessments. And finally, the Secretary of Education can make grants to states to allow them to audit their assessment systems to ensure that there is not an unnecessary amount of time being spent on assessments and there is not unnecessary overlap among assessment systems. Next, the flexibility around accountability. First, I'd like to talk about the flexibility around measurements. States must set up measurement systems that meaningfully differentiate schools on an annual basis, and they must include four types of indicators. They must have a proficiency indicator, which is basically how well students are achieving on the state exams. But for high school, that can also include a growth measure. They need to include another academic indicator for the grades in which they are held accountable. For K through 8, this can be a growth measure or another academic indicator. For high schools, this indicator needs to be the graduation rate. The third indicator is the state's progress in achieving English language proficiency for English language learners. And states have the option to select of their own choosing an additional indicator that is a non-academic indicator. And in the Every Student Succeeds Act, this is called the School Quality or Student Success Indicator, or SQSS. The state is required to give substantial weight to each indicator and much greater weight to academic indicators than to the non-academic indicator. The flexibility that states have in this measurement piece is that states now can include growth as well as proficiency in their measures, so it is not a single score, but also including the growth of students. States can determine how they will weight their indicators and what specific measures will go into those weights, although there is the requirement that the academic indicators are weighted more significantly than the non-academic indicators. The non-academic indicator, the SQSS indicator, states can choose for their own. It needs to be valid, reliable, comparable, and statewide. But it can be, other than that, and other than being a non-academic indicator, it's pretty open. There have been suggestions that that indicator can include things such as student engagement, educator engagement, student completion of advanced coursework, such as AP or dual enrollment, measures of post-secondary readiness, and measures of school climate and safety. In the second part of accountability, I'd like to talk a little bit about the reporting requirements. States must prepare and disseminate report cards every year at the state and local levels. This is the same as it was in NCLB. The specific requirements in the report cards are somewhat different. The states still need to describe their accountability system and provide the results on all of their accountability indicators. They also, however, need to report the assessment participation rate. And as I mentioned before, they need to have some sort of a weight on the assessment participation such that districts that do not have the 95% participation rate have that counted against them in their final summative rating. They need to report on the professional qualifications of educators, especially the distribution of educators among high poverty and low poverty schools, per pupil expenditures by funding source, federal, state, or local, and the National Assessment of Education Progress, or NAEP, results. NAEP results are a new requirement that was not in NCLB. There is some flexibility in this space. States are, and again, here I would caution that we should stick to the letter of the law because the regulations may change with the new administration. In the letter of the law, the states are responsible for setting their own subgroup size. The regulations have stated that this minimum subgroup size that is recommended is 30, but those regulations may change. Finally, in the past, states had to publish summative ratings for their schools, and now there is no requirement in the law for a single summative rating. There can be a dashboard for each school. Schools just need to be able to be distinguished from each other so that the lowest 5% of Title I schools can be identified for interventions. Finally, around interventions, states are required to set ambitious long-term goals and measure progress in proficiency, high school graduation, assessment proficiency, high school graduation, and English language proficiency. They are required to identify two types of schools for intervention: comprehensive support and improvement schools and targeted support and intervention schools. The comprehensive support schools are those schools that are the lowest 5% of Title I schools or high schools with less than 67% graduation rate. The targeted support schools are those schools that have consistently underperforming subgroups. States are also required to use evidence-based interventions. The flexibility in this area is around interventions. In No Child Left Behind, there were four very prescriptive models that were used, required for school interventions. Now states can develop their own interventions, and in fact, local schools and districts are the ones who are responsible for developing the interventions that will work best in their schools, and the states are asked to approve those interventions that will go into the comprehensive support and improvement schools and be consulted on the ones that will be used in the targeted support and intervention schools. In the area of funding, the two areas of greatest confusion have been supplement, not supplant, and school-based budgeting, so I want to discuss them briefly. First of all, in supplement, not supplant, the key idea behind supplement, not supplant has always been that federal dollars do not supplant state dollars in providing funds for at-risk students. In the past, what that meant was that any program that was funded by Title I of ESEA could not be a program that then also received state or local funds. That requirement has now been removed. While states do need to still spend their Title I dollars on Title I schools, Title I funds are no longer restricted to programs, only programs that receive no state or local dollars. Instead, the bar that must be passed by states is that state and local funds need to be allocated equitably between Title I schools and non-Title I schools within each district. If states are doing that, then they have a lot of flexibility around how they are using their federal dollars as long as they are being targeted to at-risk students. Here's another place where the Secretary of Education's powers are greatly limited. The Secretary cannot require an LEA to identify an individual cost or service as supplemental, and they cannot require an LEA to provide services through a specific method. In school-based budgeting, this is a new requirement that states must account for expenditures at the school level. This is going to require many states to re-examine their data systems because many states now report expenditures at the district level and not at the school level. And they are now be required to provide school-level accounting for both personnel and non-personnel costs. However, there is some flexibility that goes with this. The states can give schools waivers to provide school-wide Title I programs, which then gives even more flexibility to schools to use their Title I funds. If a school receives a school-wide Title I waiver from the state, they can then use the money across the school in any way to benefit all students and not only students at risk. In addition, in Title IV, there's a consolidated grant that replaces many specialized programs. The consolidated grant has three requirements. One is for a well-rounded education, two is for supporting safe and healthy schools, and three is for supporting the effective use of technology. Since it is one large sum of money, however, there is a lot of flexibility for states in terms of how they allocate those dollars and meet those requirements. Finally, I'd just like to mention a few strategic considerations as states make these decisions, that it is truly important for states to develop a state vision and to develop that first with all stakeholders. And I know that Oregon has done an amazing job of developing a state vision, bringing together many stakeholders to develop this vision. And I'd just like to commend Oregon for doing that, and then also to recommend that that vision should drive the funding, assessment, and accountability work that is done for the state through the federal funds. And by letting that vision drive the allocations through that flexibility, you can make sure that you have your priorities aligned with your funding streams. Secondly, I wanted to mention something about systems change, which is that it's important to keep in mind what is the outcome you want from whether it's your assessment system or your accountability system, that if it is a system directed towards local school improvement, that's going to have different factors than a system that is geared towards systems change. So that's just something to keep in mind. Finally, that ESEA was written as a civil rights document, and that the federal funds were allocated to states to provide equitable opportunity to education for all children. And I recommend that all states pay attention to this as they design their accountability and funding systems. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Any quick questions? Representative Frederick.
First question is, I'd love to have a chance to talk with you at length. I have some significant concerns. You'll probably hear about that from other people if you talk with anybody in the state education system. Particularly, I think that you have not made the case that the testing system helps the kids. I think we've made the case that the testing system helps get the data for the state and for the feds, but we don't have I think that case has not been made for the parents and for the teachers. So that's something I would like to have a conversation with you about. That adds to the situation regarding the opt-out situation. I happen to think that it's appropriate for parents and teachers. Most of the teachers that I know who have kids in school opt their kids out of those tests. So that tells me that something is different there, and that's because the tests don't really seem to be dealing with higher-order skills. They seem to be doing something else, and the outcome is not something that's in terms of supporting education.
Yes, we need to talk to our federal people about that.
Yes, and well, yeah. I mean, you have connections directly with the federal people on that, and the presentations that you've been able to give. I know I've back in D.C. to see some of these things, and this is something we need to be able to be working on. So I'd like to talk with you about that because I think we need to be addressing this in a different approach, different attitude. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your appearance before committee today. Question I would have, I see from your website that you engage in lots of research and report writing. Do you have any cumulative numbers from among the states on what cost of compliance is by state to meet the federal standards?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, thank you for the question. I don't have that summative information, but and I'll turn to my colleague to see if she knows whether we are collecting that information.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I am not aware that we have figures on that, but let us do a little digging and go back and talk to our folks, and we'll make sure we circle back with you.
Great.
That's
Thank
a great
you.
Question. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative McLean.
I'm just trying to figure out how you fit into everything. Are you a private business?
No, sorry, Madam Chair, Representative McLean, thank you for the question. No, the Education Commission of the States is a membership organization. Our members are our commissioners,
okay.
who are the governor, the generally the chair of the House Education Committee, the chair of the Senate Education Committee, and then often the state superintendent and the SHEO.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the information. I like the term flexibility being used quite a bit, flexibility at the state level. But thank you very much for coming. We've got a little nice little weather for you today.
thank you very much.
But thank you so much for the information.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have an update from the Deputy Superintendent, Dr. Noor.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education. And I'm also joined by my colleague. I'll let her introduce herself.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Dawn Huckabee. I am the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and share some information with you, an update essentially about the development and progress we've made on the state plan for the Every Student Succeeds Act. We appreciate our colleagues from ECS giving you this background and emphasizing the flexibility that's been afforded to us as a state. And we're going to share with you at a very high level, recognizing that you are pressed for time, some of the recommendations that have emerged as a result of the collaborative process that we've developed statewide. So I'm going to jump into the presentation really quickly, and I'm going to use the ECS presentation as a way to frame some of the recommendations that are being put forward as part of our state plan. Okay. I wanted to use this slide in particular. This is the Department of Education strategic plan and goals, not necessarily to go over the goals with you, but to underscore the importance of having a state vision and state priorities to drive this conversation and the plan that we submit to the U.S. Department of Education. Our involvement with No Child Left Behind that ESSA replaces focused a great deal on compliance and regulations, and the state plan was based on the guidance and direction from the U.S. Department of Education. This is an opportunity for us to step back, develop our own plan, and figure out how the resources that we receive under ESSA helps us develop that plan and develop the system that we want for all of our students here in the state of Oregon. So it's an opportunity to leverage those resources. It's an opportunity to leverage this opportunity to create the systems and the things that we want for students in every school and every community in our state. So that is the purpose behind this slide. This is where we've been. We've had an effort to engage Oregonians in practically every corner of the state. The yellow dot indicates where we've been, and the pink one indicates where we're going. And the purpose here is to engage as many Oregonians as we possibly can, get as many voices in this conversation as we possibly can, to really help inform the direction that we want to go as a state relative to the hopes, dreams, goals, and aspirations that we have for every student. Recognizing that this is a civil rights law, this is a law that's founded on equity, and that is integral to everything that we do in the process. So we use the visioning as a way to frame those conversations in all of these communities to help them understand that this is Oregon's plan, it's their plan, what matters is what's important to them locally. So, okay. So as we leverage these resources, recognizing that it is an equity law and it's intended to serve students that fit into these categories, our migrant students, our English learners, students that are living and navigating poverty, this is designed to be for enrichment opportunities and supports for students, such as after school, before school, and serving the needs of our homeless students. This is an opportunity for us to engage in some conversations around the key elements of the system, and those are standards and assessment, accountability and school and district improvement, and educator effectiveness. So recognizing that the law is intended to be supplemental to the supports and the resources that we provide for these different student groups, this is an opportunity to leverage this law to think about the systems that we want to design to inform instructions, the quality of instructions, the quality of educators, the quality of education, and the accountability systems that go along with that. And I'm really proud to tell you that as a state, we've done a lot in these areas. Many of the flexibility that's been afforded to us under this law are things that we believe in at a very deep level, things that we've actually have done work in and started to do new work in them as well. So that is very opportune for us. And the idea is to maximize the funding flexibility and to align those resources with state resources to serve students in our schools and communities. So as you think about this law, we approached it from the premise of what does it really mean for us? And if you're a student, what does it mean for you as a student? What does it mean for our students? And we've had the opportunities to hear students and to really listen very carefully to their insights and their perspectives as we did the community forums around the state. This morning I had the opportunity to meet with 30 students that represent student councils from around the state, and some of you may have visited with them today. Really bright and outstanding young individuals, and they reinforced for us what we believe in. They reinforced for us the recommendations that have been put forward by educators and communities around the state. And they all articulated very clearly what it means to have a well-rounded education. Many of them are engaged in school and out of school activities. Many of them are engaged in civic activities, community-based activities, and they're contributing in many ways and learning in different ways. So for students, this means a well-rounded education, a comprehensive education, and that's something that we've committed to as a state. But unfortunately, I think the curriculum has narrowed and has become more focused as a result of the compliance nature of No Child Left Behind. So the opportunity for us now is to step back and say, what does a well-rounded education actually look like? And it's one that affords students a range of opportunities and experiences, both in school and out of school. I won't go through this list with you, but you can see this is what we believe constitutes a well-rounded education. We also asked, what does it mean for teachers? I think for teachers, it affords them some flexibility around professional development and access to resources that were restricted in the past. So Title IIA dollars specifically were restricted for teacher professional development in reading and math. Under ESSA, those resources have been made available to all teachers in CTE, in the arts, in music, and a variety of other subjects. So it's an opportunity to access resources to continue professional development and growth on the part of our teachers. It also provides resources for ongoing and meaningful culturally responsive training for our teachers and our educators in general, because that also includes administrators. It relaxes the restrictions on evaluation. It maintains the spirit and the principles of Senate Bill 290 that established a framework for evaluation and a system for evaluation across all schools and districts in the state, but it doesn't require that the evaluation use student performance on state test for evaluation purposes. So it does provide some flexibility in that regard. It maintains testing, as you heard, in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school for math and English language arts and once in science at the elementary, middle, and high school level. What does it mean for school districts? I think for school districts, it potentially will provide, it gives districts the opportunity to provide more comprehensive information to their communities. So you learned about school quality and student success indicators that potentially can be included in a report card that goes to the community that really highlights the positive things and the important things that are happening at that school. So the idea here is that the schools and districts will be able to to share successes and areas of improvement, and I'll go through that with you here briefly. But it's really moving away from a very narrowly focused report card to the community to one that's more comprehensive and more meaningful and relevant to what's happening in that school. I think this is really critical for communities as well. Our engagement was really an attempt to model for communities the importance of all voices, the importance of having educators, community representatives, business leaders, community-based organizations, and all members of the community, including students, involved in this conversation to talk about what's important for us as a community, what types of schools do we want to have, what are the resources that we need to allocate to make sure that certain programs are available. So the emphasis is really on partnership and collaboration in order to improve outcomes for all students and to really get communities to truly think about all students and to diversify the interventions and the supports that we provide for different types of students that need different types of supports. So that has been really exciting and very positive for us. So I'm going to share with you now some draft components, and I apologize, we're going to have to do this at a very high level, but we would be happy to come back and give you more detailed information. But the draft components focus around these four areas that our colleagues from ECS discussed with you and we had shared with you in the past: standards, assessment, accountability, and school improvement and educator effectiveness. So under the area of standards and assessment, we heard very loud and clear from students, teachers, all of the members that participated in our community forums and our public engagement process that we need to maintain high, rigorous standards for all students. Standards that are engaging, standards that are meaningful, standards that prepare students for life after high school, if you will. The area of flexibility that we intend to take advantage of is in the area of assessment. As you heard from ECS, states have the option to consider alternative assessments at the high school level. So instead of SBAC, we have the option to consider nationally norm reference assessments such as SAT, ACT, and perhaps others. And we intend to take full advantage of that opportunity. And as a result, we will be bringing a group together to help us identify criteria that will go into an RFI, a request for information, and this will be an invitation to all vendors out there to tell us how their assessment will meet the requirements in the law and will be a quality assessment that's accessible and meets all of the requirements that are established by the U.S. Department of Education. Whatever assessment we choose still has to go through peer review and get approved by the U.S. Department of Education. But our intention is to take advantage of this flexibility and offer alternative assessments at the high school level. I think the question that we are grappling with and we will need to discuss is, can we afford multiple assessments? And if we can, how many? And the rationale and the justification for having multiple assessments. So there are pros and cons to this without getting into the details. You heard about the use of interim assessments instead of a summative assessment as an option, and we intend to pilot that in science. So as we bring our science assessment on board, we're interested in developing, let's say, for example, three interim assessments that will be offered at three different times during the school year, and to do a calibration between the cumulative score on those three assessments compared to a state summative assessment. So if a student does really well on those three assessments, there's no need for them to take the summative assessment. Those assessments could be a lot more meaningful to teachers because they would be able to use that information right away to inform their instruction, to provide supports and interventions for students that have not performed well in certain areas or in certain standards. So we're very excited about that. And if we are successful in that regard, we could potentially look at science. We can look at math and reading as well and have interim assessments in lieu of a summative assessment and make that option available. It'll take us some time to actually get there, but this is something that we're committed to, and it's flexibility that we intend to take advantage of. I think our main concern is to make sure that that assessment is it's aligned, it's reliable, it's a quality assessment, it's a fair and equitable assessment, it meets all of the accommodations and all of the requirements that the U.S. Department of Education requires. I think under accountability and reporting, we are proposing to not use an overall summative assessments for schools, and rather to rely on a dashboard approach. And that dashboard, as I showed you earlier in a previous slide, would have a lot more information that really represents what's happening in that school. So each indicator on the dashboard would be rated, and the rating would not be numerical. It would be on a progress scale to say they're beginning, they're intermediate, they're making progress, they're not making progress, they're seeing growth, they're not seeing growth. So it will be more of a qualitative assessment. It will not limit our ability to identify schools that need that would be in need of improvement, like our low-performing schools. What's exciting about this, and I'm going to show you the slide to show you, to just reveal some of the areas that have been recommended for us. So we've categorized these into three areas: opportunity to learn, academic success, and college and career readiness. And under each, you see there is a delineation for elementary and middle, and one for high school, and there are some future indicators that we will probably look at and incorporate into this report. So under opportunity to learn at the elementary and middle, it's consistent with our state priorities around chronic absenteeism, English language proficiency. Growth is a key component of this model. And data aligned to equitable educator plan, diversifying our workforce and ensuring that teachers have access to culturally responsive pedagogy and instruction training, and then the disproportionate discipline. So the things that we've worked on as a state that you have supported as a legislature will be included in this report card, because that's what you value, that's what we value, that's what the state values, therefore they're going to be included in this report card. So this just gives you an idea of some of the information that will be provided to parents and the community. And I think when you put it on a just a numerical scale, you lose something. I think if you put it on a progression scale, I think it provides more information and leads to more meaningful conversations. Oops, sorry. Okay, doesn't want to go. Just try that. Okay. So here is an example.
Oops, of how hit that the wrong would, button.
So here's an example of what this report card, this is a mock-up report card. We will need to bring some groups together to actually look at the details of it, the design and the content. But it provides a lot more information, and you see the categories and the indicators. So under chronic absenteeism, this particular school has improved. Under disproportionate discipline, they stayed about the same. So I think it just provides more meaningful and relevant information for parents and communities and educators, I hope, relative to what's happening in their school. So under the area of school improvement, as you heard from our colleagues at ECS, we will still be required to identify schools that are targeted for interventions. Currently, we call those schools focus and priority schools. The new designations for them will be comprehensive and targeted, and we will find we will establish a formula that allows us to identify those schools and partner with them to make sure that we're making progress in improving the instruction at that school, so we have equitable outcomes for all students. We will continue to bring stakeholders together to determine what the key indicators will be. You heard about the participation rate, you heard about academic and non-academic indicators. So we will continue to engage with our partners from the field to actually develop the categories with more specificity and detail as to how are we going to identify our targeted and priority schools. Would you like to talk about educator effectiveness?
Certainly. So under educator effectiveness, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dawn Huckabee again for the record. Under educator effectiveness, we have some opportunities, as Salam mentioned, really around integrating our equitable access to educator plan that is currently a statewide plan, and really bringing that into the conversation versus it being something completely different and separate. And so we're very excited about looking at those strategies that are identified there and incorporating them into this plan. We're really looking, again, along that lines of not having a summative rating. Currently, educators, there's a summative rating that is submitted based on evaluations. And so it comes in as just a single score. And so we're really looking at how do we have a broader definition of what we mean by an effective educator. And so we're currently looking at kind of what are those big four areas around instruction and how would we get that information from our schools and districts to have a better sense in each of those core areas what we mean by an effective educator. And as Salam mentioned, really making sure that the summative assessment, we're very interested in keeping student growth and student learning at the forefront of educator evaluations and goals and keeping that, but not having it tied to that state assessment and that requirement. And we are really working on what do we mean when we say an effective educator, and across all of our constituencies across the state, and making sure that all students are engaged in culturally responsive and sustaining practices, and our teachers are engaged. engaged in that as well.
Yeah, and what I would add is that instead of creating a separate plan to meet the ESSA requirement, we're using the plan that we already have for Oregon because we think it's the right plan. It's one that you've supported, resourced, and we've built capacity for it in our state. So we're pretty excited about that. Educator effectiveness.
So under Title IIA, there is an opportunity to set aside, for the state to set aside some of its Title IIA resources specifically for teacher and administrator leadership. And so it's our intent to take that opportunity. And really, we don't have specific strategies yet, but we're looking at how would we use that to support our educators who want to stay in the classroom and be teacher leaders and leader and have their voices elevated at the building level, as well as those who are going into specifically building administration, district administration, so that they have a strong understanding of the challenges and the strategies that will help them move their schools and districts forward. So we're excited about that opportunity to be able to set aside some resource specifically for that we've not been able to do in previous federal funding sources.
Yep. And I think this is where we're taking advantage of the flexibility that's been afforded to us. So Title IIA dollars went directly to schools to support professional development for either reading and math, for the most part, and for teachers specifically. We've been given the opportunity to set aside a small portion of those resources and to use them specifically on developing administrators and administrators' capacity to do this work and teacher leadership. And teacher leadership does not mean teachers on a path to become administrators. It's teachers that want to be in more leadership roles that can impact what's happening at a school or a district level or a community, but not necessarily be on a path to become an administrator. They're not interested in being an administrator, but they want to lead, they want to contribute, they want to work with adults in the building or the district. And what's exciting about this, especially as we look at administrators in particular, either aspiring administrators or existing administrators, I want to direct your attention to the first two bullets specifically. One is enhance the understanding of culturally responsive pedagogy and instruction. We tend to focus on teachers in this area. I think it's equally important to focus on administrators and build their capacity in this regard because they're the ones who create the culture and the support systems for it at the school level. The other is establish school improvement priorities, focus on improving instruction for struggling students, particularly students of color, students with disabilities, English learners, and students experiencing or living in poverty. So there is a great deal of intentionality about how we intend to use those resources to build both administrators' capacities, just like we do with teachers, but also teacher leadership. And the other two bullets are equally important. Almost done, I promise. So the last thing that I wanted to share with you is really the timeline that we're on. We've had the four work groups. The four work groups have actually concluded their work. They've made some recommendations. Those recommendations are being vetted by the statewide advisory committee. And we still have ongoing stakeholder engagement in a variety of formats. Some of it is direct interface with communities. This morning, I used the 30 students as a focus group, and they gave us lots of information about what's great in their school experience and what they would change. It was very insightful. The next phase is really the initial drafting of the state plan, sharing that with stakeholders. The regulations were finalized 2 weeks ago. We were pleased about that because it'll give us some specificity as to how to tailor the state plan. We will finalize the state plan between January and April, continue to get public comment, go through the state board process, the governor, and then submission to the U.S. Department of Education. This is the timeline for actual implementation. So 17-18 is when the implementation begins. We are transitioning to a new accountability system and school identification. We will not actually implement the accountability system until the 18-19 school year, so we still have the current assessment system and evaluation system. We will identify our lowest performing schools for comprehensive support in 18-19 and our targeted support schools in 19-20. Madam Chair, thank you so much for for the time and for your interest in this topic. I hope this gives you an idea of some of the specific things that potentially will go into the state plan and inform our work as a state and in terms of the education that we want to afford every student. We're happy to take any questions that you may have for us.
Okay.
Or comments.
Thank you. I do have two questions that have been brought to me, and one deals, first of all, with chronic absenteeism.
Yes.
And so as chronic absentee, it continues to be a concern of many of us. Could you provide like a brief update as to the chronic absenteeism statewide plan
Absolutely.
That was released this month?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. The chronic absenteeism state plan was actually released on December 1st, as requested by the legislature, and we appreciate the opportunity and the resources to work on it. This was a collaboration between the Chief Education Office and my colleagues here behind me, and the Department of Education and other stakeholders that contributed to the development of that plan. There are some key recommendations, if I may just go over them really quickly, and we would be happy to come back and give you more details, especially the experts that worked on the plan and can be a lot more substantive and detailed than I am. But some of the recommendations include adoption of a statewide definition of chronic absenteeism. For example, 10% or more days of school of schools missed, including excused, unexcused, and disciplinary expulsion consistent with federal and civil rights data collection. That gives us some uniformity across the state as to what we would consider to be chronic absenteeism. The second recommendation is provide chronic absenteeism data on state report card as part of the ESSA non-academic measure. So there is a possibility of including that on the report card that I shared a mock-up of with you.
And Sandy did say that she would put it on the OLIS system, so everyone would have access to the report, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Because we do have it, but thank you.
Absolutely. And there, the recommendation is also to include 20 trained coaches to assist with the most impacted schools, and that is where you have less than 20% of the students chronically absent. The fourth recommendation is to create regional structures to provide funding for regional systems that actually involve communities that work with schools relative to those issues, because sometimes the solution is actually with the community and within the community and not just exclusively within the school. So this calls for collaboration with community organizations, the use of an early warning system that we're also recommending that be available and implemented statewide, looking at a systematic attendance audit process, support for statewide multi-tiered system of supports, support coaches, culturally responsive training for educators. So these are some of the strategies that have been recommended under that category. And finally is positive messaging campaign at state level and with support to local level, meaning that this is something that we all should be talking about. This is something that we should all emphasize and underscore. This is something that we should create urgency around and make sure that everybody understands the importance of being in school for kids to learn and be successful, and that we all share a sense of responsibility and obligation to help our students and our schools address this issue.
Okay,
so this is at a very high level, gives you the five recommendations.
Right. If we just have questions on this particular thing, because I've got another question to answer quickly, please.
The one item that you spoke of there, because I've looked at the report, and it was on the definition that was going to be statewide that was on chronic absenteeism, and I think the concept is great, but as you repeated it again today, it says both excused and unexcused, and excused is part of something else you talked about today, which is activities inside and outside of the school building that are school-related, academic-related, critical thinking-related, you know, well-rounded related.
Right.
So that conversation is still to be had. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, absolutely. Those are the things that we have to look at, because in some cases, the out-of-school activities that are associated with a program or instruction that's in school is what keeps kids in school, mm-hmm. and motivates them to come to school. So thank you. Absolutely. We will continue to work on that.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Next time we talk or when we get an opportunity, I'd like to address the issue of coaches more.
Okay.
There's a little skepticism down in my area about that, as who the coaches are, what their qualifications are, what their techniques will be, what they hope to impart, what's new. And so, again, love to hear about that soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Quickly, Representative, on this issue?
On the absenteeism?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Okay, and then the second question we had dealt with Measure 98 implementation, and with the passage of 98 and as we start to plan for the next biennium, could you provide an update as to the department's plan and timeline for implementation of 98?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So as proposed, the measure sets aside $800 per student for CTE, dropout prevention, and expanding dual credit opportunities. The governor's budget is supportive of Measure 98 and sets aside resources for the implementation of Measure 98. What I will tell you is that it requires the Department of Education to develop rules and to have those rules in place by March 1st, I believe, right? By March 1st. So we're currently engaged with the Chief Ed Office, with stakeholders and other partners in the field to actually go through the rulemaking process. We held a meeting on December 6th, and we had about 40-plus participants from lots of different groups that have an interest in this topic, and we're currently working on the rulemaking process, and we intend to keep the engagement with stakeholders to better understand how to best implement this law and to make sure that it actually gets us to the outcome that's desired by the law.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions on 98?
Thank you, Dr. Nori. On that issue, though, because of the timeline, it's also related to the budget. Mm-hmm. And it's also related to the fact that you've got a legislature involved in looking at a governor's budget. And so what are some of the tactics or what are some of the timelines that's going to help us be inserted in the process of review and talk about some of the major language that is really rather confusing and definitionally challenging that I think is up and above a rulemaking process. And so how do we get to that conversation? We have some career development classes, for example, that I was told would be able to get possibly that $800 per pupil in my own personal district, and yet as I look at the definitions, I don't think they could possibly pass muster because they've been established since 1974. Mm-hmm. So it's a situation where I'm hoping to understand how we get involved in that process and that conversation, because we're not talking rulemaking, we're talking basic measure here.
Right. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, you're absolutely correct. There are some definitions that need to be established, and that's why we're engaged in this process with stakeholders that will get to the clarity of what we mean by CTE program, what we mean by supplement and supplant. What do we mean by an existing program compared to new or expansion? So those are the conversations that we are having with the stakeholders. Some of that information will need to be included in the rulemaking process. And I'm looking at my colleague here, Lindsay, we will be happy to come back and share with you some additional information and make some recommendations as to how we define those categories, how we support them, how we resource them. The commitment is there for the implementation of Measure 98, and the governor allocated resources for it in our budget. Based on the allocation, there will be questions around, is it 800 or less? So those are the things that we're hoping to get to through this public engagement process and to come back to you with clarity around what all of those different categories mean.
Okay, thank you. And we're like 20 minutes late, so could have a quick one. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you identify the stakeholders you're working with? I just want to make sure that we've got certain folks at the table.
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, thank you for the question. So the stakeholders involve educators, and that is representatives of schools and districts around the state, including teachers and administrators, superintendents. We have COSA, OSBA, OEA, Stand for Children. We have colleges and universities represented in this conversation.
Workforce was there.
We have workforce partners in this conversation from both the CTE and the STEM world, the CTE Revitalization Committee, the STEM Council, STEAM Council. Am I missing anyone?
How about this? Are you talking about the hubs, the STEM hubs as well?
The STEM hubs are also part of the conversation. Yes, it's a very large group. We started with a small group, and it grew very quickly, and we kept adding and adding and adding, and I think we had about 40-some people. And that's exactly what we're looking at, is what are these categories? What do we mean by CTE, dropout prevention, and expanding dual credit opportunities? Mm-hmm. Because there are some existing definitions in these areas. Is this an opportunity to revisit that and clarify what we mean by it and help support schools in the implementation of this law?
Okay, can I just ask one? Well, I'll just meet with you. Let's just, yeah.
Okay. I look forward to it.
Okay, thank you very much for the update. Very greatly appreciated. Okay, we've got the home visiting program overview, and we're going to try to get you done by quarter till, please. Thank you very much.
We'll talk fast.
we only have three chairs at the time, so
okay.
I'm not sure who's
going. And if
I need one more chair.
Or somebody can start and then
I'll start. Okay. They're coming. They're out in the hall. You guys
okay.
Are so
if you want to get going, please.
Yeah. So, good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee, for the opportunity to address you today on the issue of voluntary home visiting. My name is Martha Brooks, and I am the State and Western Regional Director for Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, Ready Nation, and Champions for America's Future. I want to thank my ally partner organizations, Children Institute and Children First for Oregon, who helped put this panel together today for you. I have testifying with me today Dr. Peggy Nygren, Portland State University, the Honorable Walt Beglau, District Attorney for Marion County, a member of Fight Crime Invest in Kids, and Megan Sears, a graduate Healthy Families Oregon mom. Our purpose today is to give you information on voluntary home visiting, what it does, how it works, and why you should be interested. From the perspective of Fight Crime Invest in Kids, we absolutely believe dangerous criminals must be put behind bars, but locking them up is not the entire solution to crime. In fact, that is the end solution. A key component to crime reduction is early prevention in the form of home visiting parent coaching, such as Healthy Families America. Here in Oregon, that's Healthy Families Oregon.
No, we do have your testimony if you want to summarize or give us a big
yeah,
points.
Yeah, I have a few pieces. Yeah. So nurse family partnership, early head start. And in the testimony, it does tell you of what the improvements to school outcome and health is concerned. Mm-hmm. Parenting is the biggest challenge that many people face, and single moms for teens and for moms. Home visiting provides critical support to vulnerable children and families by matching unexpected parents with trained professionals. In Oregon, we have been leaders for many years with Healthy Families Oregon since 1993, administered through the Early Learning Division. That's why we are here. Mm-hmm. You can see in my testimony where we're working with Nurse Family Partnership, Healthy Families America, Early Head Start, and the numbers that we're filling and taking care of there. One thing not in your testimony is that Oregon just received another McVie grant in conjunction with Alaska, Idaho, and Washington for $17 million to help with professional development of home visiting. And thank you, Representative Peluso, when you were chief, you helped with that first funding.
Thank you.
Oregon has been supportive in other programs such as Babies First, Cocoon, Maternal Case Management in Oregon Health Authority. And then Relief Nurseries also provides some home visiting programs and does hold a few HFO contracts. DHS has family support and connections, and that is obviously through DHS. The unfortunate piece is that we have little resources. We know that statewide we are only servicing approximately 20% of those eligible. In Oregon, 40% of our families have two or more ACEs indicators, which feed into some of the other information that you're going to get. Frankly, they have to pick and choose who they give services to, and it's really not much fun. So I'll turn it over to the other members of my panel, and if you want and have time, we will answer questions.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Who's next?
You're okay. Next.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Peggy Nygren. I'm a researcher at Portland State University. I've been working in home visiting research now for a decade with Dr. Beth Green, who's also at PSU, and other researchers nationally doing this work. As Martha mentioned, we're talking today about home visitation programs. These are programs geared at early in the lives of infants and toddlers, with trained professionals that come in and give one-on-one support to caregivers to model developmentally appropriate behavior and nurturing child-rearing behavior. We have seen over time in countless studies, high-quality, rigorous, randomized control trials of various evidence-based models that outcomes are positive for families, both for children and for mothers. So I'm going to highlight just a couple of those key outcome areas. You've received a packet with all of those pieces in there. I'm hoping you'll all read it. Will you read it? Raise your hands if you'll read it.
That's their assignment for them.
That's your assignment. I can't go into all the detail of these studies here, obviously, in 3 minutes, but there's a great website, the HOME-V website, that has all of this literature summarized, and it's why certain programs have been chosen and why McVie has chosen those three programs for Oregon. Very specifically, we've seen improvements in maternal and child health in the area of emergency room visits and accidental poisonings. We see a 56% reduction in a nurse family partnership study from New York. We see reductions in low birth weight for children who are in these programs as well. Increased well baby visits for these families compared to families who don't join these programs. Another area we see consistent findings in is positive parenting. So if we look at discipline strategies. These families use less harsh discipline strategies. They have more emotionally supportive behaviors that they show with their families, and they they have more attachment to their children. So there's so many outcomes in the parenting area. I'm not going to go into all of them. Stress, parenting stress, is also reduced when these moms participate in these programs. And Megan was going to talk about that soon, because she's a mom who experienced some of these amazing outcomes. So we also see a reduction in child maltreatment at long-term follow-up. There are issues around maltreatment at initially when surveillance is happening in families, where that might initially seem like there's higher rates going on, but between 5 and 7 years old, we're seeing reductions in the rate of children who are first time into CPS for these programs as well. There's a lot of literature around the specific types of discipline that they have with children as well. 31% fewer acts of minor physical aggression, 88% fewer acts of severe physical abuse from ages 1 to 7 years old with follow-up, and also 30% fewer acts of psychological aggression. We see school readiness outcomes are really positive as well. How am I doing on time?
If you just want to summarize, because okay. We do have, a lot of the information.
So we see
here.
A lot of school readiness increases for school readiness and things like that as well. And the documentation shows that. Mm-hmm. The next thing I'll talk about, well, one of the things that Martha mentioned are these improvements in family stability in these areas of 59% reduction in child arrests at age 15. These are studies that have followed families that far out that we can look at how these children are doing into their teen years for crime. And also 72% fewer convictions for mothers who are in these programs. And reduction in homelessness, more economic independence, decreased use of substances and risky behaviors by the parents is also seen. Mm-hmm. The bigger part that I don't, it's not my area of study, but many people study the cost effectiveness of these programs as well, and that's noted in the materials. The Nurse Family Partnership did a study, and they showed that in 2005, they reported a net benefit to society of $34,148 per higher risk family served in Florida. That one was done in Florida. They also took data from two states in 2012 and estimated the long-term benefits of almost $23,000 per participant who participated in the family home visiting program as opposed to those who didn't. Healthy Families Model has done a lot of cost-effectiveness work, and one of the most recent studies is Dr. Beth Green, who's right here in Oregon, in Portland, who I work with. And at year 7, the Healthy Families showed $3. They had a return of $3 for every dollar invested for moms who had prior CPS histories, so were at high risk for maltreatment. We also found $1,000 to serve a family during pregnancy is totally recovered before a child's birth due to the reductions in low birth weight. The last thing I'll say about cost is that additional savings accrue for reductions in grade retention and special education services, because these children are less likely to need those services when they go into grade school. Anyway, the other point is that we are reaching families of color, and there are a number of programs that can be pointed to, including Family Spirit, the tribal McVee programs that are happening, as well as ERCO, the Healthy Birth Initiative, and Black Parent Initiative. I know there's been talk of, you know, who are we reaching and what are the percentages of people who are being served by these programs, and we can talk more about that, or if you have questions, or if you want to contact me, I can provide you with that information. The last thing I'll point out is that what Martha said, we are not reaching all the kids that we need to reach. If you look at all the risk factors for the different families and children in our state in terms of depression and poverty, maternal depression, poverty, substance use, it's upwards of 2/3 of the families that we're not reaching. And so we need to continue doing this work, and we need your help to think about this and to continue pushing for these important programs.
Okay, thank you. And Mrs. Sears, if you want to make sure you identify yourself for the record, and we do have your testimony here if you just want to summarize in a couple of minutes. Thank you so much.
My name is Megan Sears, and I was invited here to speak to you as a graduated mother of the Healthy Families in Clackamas County. I'd like to just take a moment to recall our experience with the Healthy Families and let you know what they can do for a family like mine. Not too long ago, they funded an in-home visitation program for my husband and I, and in my opinion, it resulted in permanently breaking my family's endless history of child abuse. I was born into a world of neglect and starvation, and my childhood began with an alcoholic single mom who was so addicted that 4 out of 5 of her children were born into heroin or had alcohol in our systems. Our story ends with us being taken away 10 years later due to severe physical, sexual, and emotional abuse, ongoing neglect, and serious malnourishment. When it came to parenting, I had no examples to draw from and no positive memories to guide me. And with the lack of knowledge and missing examples, I was left with little to draw from. And as far as I knew, babies were supposed to lay in their own filthy diapers to learn a lesson about soiling themselves. So as you can see, I was dangerously unequipped to take care of children. The morning after my son was born, I heard a knock on the door, and it was a visitor from Healthy Families. And I didn't know it at the time, but she was the answer to my husband and I's prayers. Over the next 3 years, our home visitor counseled me about postpartum depression and gave me tools I could count on to get through a parenting crisis. When I didn't know how to handle my son or myself, she taught me how to cope by giving me very simple steps that I could recall. In those first couple years as a mother, when I would get angry, dealing with it appropriately was something I had to train myself to do. And separating what I had been shown versus how I wanted to treat my babies was something Healthy Families gave me. My children continue to benefit from this program every day. Every time their milestones change or they need me to step up, I'm there for them because Healthy Families was there for me. We are 7 years into our parenting now, and my husband and I continue our education, and we support each other in our journey with positive discipline and co-sleeping and attachment parenting and breastfeeding and all those wonderful things, all the things that Healthy Family showed us. We proudly hold true to the Healthy Family values. We don't hit our children, and they're growing in a home where they don't have to fear their mother. Healthy Families gave that gift to my children and I. Not every mother's story begins like mine when she enters Healthy Families, but I can offer my story as an example of what an abuse prevention program can do for a family. I sit in front of you as a glimpse of what their hard work and dedication can do not only for a hopeful mother, but an entire generation of children.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. District Attorney.
Oh, thank you,
Madam
Chair.
I need to look
Chair.
On the agenda to see what your name was. I just know my district attorney. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Walt Begla. I serve as the district attorney and pleased to be speaking alongside our coalition partners here. And although this is outside my book of work, I have to say if I can lend any support, it would be in the area of investments in early childhood prevention and intervention programs, and in particular home visiting. I have to tell you that at any given time in our juvenile court where we're doing the dependency work, trying to wrap our arms around those challenged families that have made their way into the system, there's three generations of families sitting on the bench. And what this home visiting and other programs do is change the trajectory of that inevitable place for seats for those three women sitting in our juvenile court. That's what those investments do. The way I see it, investments in home visiting for a 4-year-old and her mother and their family is not low-hanging fruit. It's fruit on the ground in terms of the expense you're going to pay later from prosecution and the investments in public safety. So that's the public safety, law enforcement. We're behind these investments for the little ones and their families. So thank you for that, Megan. The other piece, and Martha mentioned this, is the point about ACEs study. And I have to tell you, recently our community was privileged to host Dr. Folletti here in Marion County. We had a huge attendance there, and he's the primary author of this adverse child experiences study where they took nearly 17,000 folks and identified what's causing child abuse and continued experiences around abuse and physical harm to families in our world. And we had a front row seat. You could hear a pin drop when he was speaking, basically saying, what happens to a baby who's born healthy and ready to enter this world with all the supports, and then 18 years later is lying in a gutter with an addiction? Mm-hmm. What happens? And what they found was, when they talked to all these men and women older in their life, is that what they presented, whether it was addiction or obesity, whatever the issue was, that was a symptom of experiences they had when they were a three-year-old. Neglect, emotional harm, sexual abuse, loss of a parent, and that you turned your focus on those experiences, you can identify how to change the course for that particular child. And so that's what we want to do. We want to go down, you know, back upstream and look at those experiences. And that's why home visiting. I want to draw the nexus between that really expensive treatment we have to do down the road to those families. And the ACEs studies knocks it out of the park when you really sit down and look through that and see those experiences that Megan shared with you today and so many others have experienced as well. So that's the connection. That's why public safety is behind home visiting. That's why it's a good investment and an investment in me. I'll just say it. It's a little too late when you're investing in your district attorney, right? So thanks for your time today. Thanks for your time today. And I really do am honored to be here, and I'm honored to be with this team here representing public safety. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Any quick questions? Yeah.
Just a comment. Again, I have worked with Martha Brooks and Fight Crime, Invest in Kids for 20 plus years, if not more now, for exactly what the district attorney has talked about. I mean, that's the motivation. That's what we need to do. That's how we're going to change the world. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Yes.
And congratulations on your parenting.
Yes.
That's excellent.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, thank you all for what you do, and thank you for coming and testifying today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next group we have, update on African American Student Success Plan. So, Markeisha. We don't have names. REAP, SEI, Immigrant and Refugee Community, Iraco, and Multnomah, and D.E. Long.
Okay. So we only have, we've got four chairs. So somebody.
Well, whoever wants to come up.
Yeah, we'll have to. And then they can identify themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know where everybody went.
Markeisha, do you want everybody up at one time, or
I can call you up. And
okay.
It's
okay.
Up to you all.
We're trying to save a couple minutes here in transition.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Markeisha Smith, and I'm the director for the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Office at the Oregon Department of Education. And here just to really give a brief update on where we are now with House Bill 2016. And I am joined by many colleagues in the room who are current grant recipients from this House bill, and they'll be sharing a couple of minutes each just on what their progress is and where they are in this process, and happy to have them with me today. So with that, so our advisory group now has been meeting a little over a year. Their first meeting was in October, actually, of last year. And you can see here where we are currently. And so we've been having monthly meetings, even as we are finalizing what will be the plan that we submit this legislative session. Our group has expressed the desire to continue meeting and really coming together to have deep conversation about where we are in this process and to continue helping make recommendations moving forward for our African American and Black students in Oregon. We had the opportunity to really utilize the expertise within our advisory group by having them work in resource teams. And so we had expertise from, you know, pre-kindergarten all the way through college. And so it made the most sense for us as we were going through this process to really give them the opportunity to use those skills in an area with like-minded folks, right? Really thinking about the sorts of skills and resources that they bring to the table. And so you'll see here where we have our research team, our resource teams, and where they were working. and really what we wanted them to do in addition to thinking about kind of a long-term plan was to also really think about what are some recommendations, right, short-term, right? So we've been working long-term, short-term, which is what you'll see on the next slide. And I think it's really been a good way to view the work at this point in time because we did get a little bit of a later start. If you'll remember, we didn't actually have access to grant funds until April of this year. And so once, you know, everything, RFP went out and everything was awarded, grantees were funded toward the end of the summer. And so we really are just kind of getting into the work now. And so that was really, really important to think about how we approach this. So this slide just shows you briefly year one, what our short-term goals were, again, thinking about the short time frame that we had. And so these three buckets around attendance, chronic absenteeism, parent and community engagement, and transitions were really sort of the three buckets where speaking with members on the advisory group and thinking about where we were in this process seemed to make the most sense. I think the piece obviously around attendance and chronic absenteeism is very timely, given what you've heard here earlier today and some of the work that's been happening with ODE and our chief education office. And then in terms of long-term goals, this is where we've really been sort of coming back to now a process of beginning to put information into what would be the plan for African American and Black students in our state. And these were really for us, you know, we've got much more than this, but now it's really the process of sort of narrowing down some of the recommendations and thinking about what are some of the themes that we're seeing across each of our resource teams. And at this point, this is where we are. I think it there's nothing really surprising here. I think what really is important to us is thinking about the strategies that go to address what we see here as themes and toward our long-term goals, and that we're thinking very specifically about our students and families that are a part of the process here. So that is where we are long term. And then this graphic, I think, does a really good job of illustrating the reach that we've had currently with our current grantees. And so we have each of the projects, as I mentioned a moment ago, will come up and speak briefly about what they're doing at this point. But you'll see the school districts that they're connected with. Our Bars to Bridges program works specifically with students really getting districts, folks prepared to have students re-enter their home schools. And they'll speak a little bit about what that looks like. But this is where we're reaching. And a lot of this for these organizations has been an expansion of some existing work and really thinking differently about how they're reaching students and families in places where they might not have before. I think the other point, and some of our grantees will drive this home, is that this isn't just about sort of the academic pieces, that it is really around the other supports that have to be in place in order to ensure that African American and Black students have a successful experience in school and that they have the supports that they need, family and community, to be able to do that. And I think that is really in some ways what makes this unique from some of the other things that we've been involved in. And so with that, that's kind of my spiel. I'm going to have them come up and join me. So if Mark Jackson and Reed, they're in the room.
Yes, come on up.
You're almost a regular, Mr. Jackson.
You have to sit so far away, Mark.
I was.
Oh, the mic. Okay.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Mark Jackson. I'm the Executive Director for REAP Incorporated. As you all may know, the mission of REAP is to proactively ignite and elevate and engage the next wave of leaders. And in effort to address the transitions and attendance issues, REAP is empowering students to elevate their voice to be a part of the education process through leadership programming, civic engagement, restorative justice practices. Black African American students grades 3 through 12 are benefiting from culturally responsive supports during and after school that are putting them on the trajectory to graduation. The REAP project provides a student-led school climate survey that assesses the learning environments of schools through an equity lens. This, too, has become a gateway for school faculty to receive culture-responsive training related to restorative practice and also trauma-informed care. This three-tiered approach of direct services to students, school climate assessment work, and also professional development for educators is changing the narrative of teaching and learning for Black and African American students within our state. Some early success indicators is that one of our school sites has received a 70% decrease in discipline and behavior issues based upon data compared to the last school year. We've getting response, anecdotal responses from our teachers who are being a part of the actual training that's culture responsive, to where they're asking the question now, the administrators, why aren't all teachers being a part of this training? That speaks to the value of what these grantees are providing to the actual school communities. Also, in terms of leadership, one of our REAP students who attend Centennial High School, who's biracial, has a real burden around police brutality and also racism, and had the opportunity to kind of present her letter of concern to the mayor of Portland, and had the opportunity to personally deliver the letter to Mayor Charlie Hales and talk about her concerns around the justice system. And he, in turn, committed to taking that letter to the actual police chief. And this student, who was blown away that her voice does matter, has relevance. So when you talk about the idea of in-school, out-of-school learning, here's a student who's seeing that their voice has impact that can influence policy on a public safety level. REAP is really distinct in terms of what it's offering our school communities. We're targeting geographic areas where there's no real strong history of culture-specific programs or serving Black kids. So we're in Centennial School District and also Beaverton, where there's really a gap in terms of services. So we are very intentional about targeting that geographic area. Also, this school climate assessment survey was framed and developed by REAP students. That's now being a tool that's being used of all of our schools to assess the school climate. And that school climate survey is really, I think, guiding the ship of support for our PD work, where teachers, administrators, counselors are being exposed to an African-American male. Wonderful. That's a wonderful. Who's educating predominantly white female teachers around how to engage and support students of color. And we're seeing such a paradigm shift in terms of the education and who's actually facilitating the education and the training. So that's a huge win for this House Bill 2016. And also, I want to add that the idea that REAP is in the elementary schools, I think of all the four grantees, we're the only one that really is serving elementary students. And we're seeing such a support in terms of our schools, K through 5 in East County. I want to conclude by saying REAP's project with its key partners are providing a promising strategy to close the opportunity gap, as well as create a renaissance where all students thrive academically and also socially. I invite you all to visit not just the REAP sites, but the sites of all the grantees to learn more personally what we're doing on the ground to ensure you make an informed decision as you move into this next legislative session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to come back to SEI. And okay. And Urkel, Rebecca.
Oh. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My name is Rebecca Lomboto, and I'm from the IRCO I'm from the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization, IRCO. We're so excited to receive this fund for this project. As the need in an African immigrant refugees community in Oregon are great, African immigrant and refugees are the fastest growing community in Oregon as of now. 75% of the African children are living in poverty. Only 27 of the African students graduated in 2011. Due to these needs, culturally specific support for the African immigrant and refugees community is extremely important. The IRCO Black African Student Success Program fills this need through culturally specific wraparound support that focuses on student academic achievement, attendance, key transition, and parent engagement. Culturally specific parent engagement is crucial in the success of the African youth and families. Parents are new in understanding the U.S. education system. Some of them have never been through formal education themselves and have limited English, with very little access to regular interpretation in school. While many are doing everything they can to help their children, they need more support. through this project, we're able to serve 210 parents and children per year across four school districts through culturally and linguistically specific school-to-home and home-to-school communication, wraparound support that includes referral to existing resource in home learning, parent group activities that focuses on school key related topics such as school attendance, parents' rights and responsibilities, graduation requirement, and more. This model for programming has proven to produce results. We're expecting BAS, Black African Student Success participants, to show an improvement in students' attendance rate above 90%, increase in math and literacy skills, leading to more students graduating on time in high school, decrease in students' behavior and referrals. While we're doing great work in this project, We'll still have a lot to work ahead of us. Culturally and linguistically specific support for the African immigrant and refugees communities, like the Black African Student Success Program, are crucial to the success of the youth and families served. This support are extremely important for eliminating disparities, closing opportunity gaps, and ensuring a fair, equitable education experience for African students in Oregon. With that being said, thank you guys.
Thank you very much. All right. Okay. And MESD? I like that title.
So, good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Scott Ryan, and I'm a principal and administrator for Multnomah Education Service District. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give you an update on our House Bill 2016 Bars to Bridges grant. I can spend the next 2 minutes giving you bullet point statistics. I can tell you that we have an opportunity to speak nationally at Clemson University about the work that we're doing at the National Dropout Prevention Network. I can tell you about dropout statistics, that juvenile detention education program youth often are now at 35% dropout rate as an average throughout the state. I can tell you that currently we're serving 97 students over 13 counties across the state. But what I'd really rather do is tell you about a student that I'm going to refer to as David. David is a 17-year-old young black male that has no prior history with the legal system, but has been disengaged from his education since ninth grade. And on November 2nd, David found himself at Donald E. Long, first time as part of the juvenile legal system. On November 30th, he was in front of a judge who released him back to the custody of his parents, his mother, but with multiple conditions. The conditions were that he re-enroll in school within four school days. He was released Wednesday afternoon at 3:31, and he had until the following Wednesday to re-engage in school, keeping in mind that David has not been in school essentially his entire high school career. Furthermore, the judge said that David is not allowed to take public transportation to and from school, that he must be escorted by a responsible adult every day to and from school. David is fortunate. He has a support network at home with his mother, who works full-time, split shifts, Monday through Friday, and an older brother who also works full-time and contributes to the family. Because of their employment, he doesn't have the opportunity to be escorted by his support network, because to do so would create financial instability as well as employment insecurity. And the judge stated that if David did not meet these conditions by Wednesday, that he would be found in violation of his release and would be placed back in juvenile detention. Had it not been for House Bill 2016 and the funding, David, I'm afraid to say, would be back in juvenile detention. Rather, because of House Bill 2016, David officially started school today at 2:50 for the first time in 3.5 years. Last Wednesday, we were able to get him through enrollment with Benson High School Reconnections High School program. He was able to go through orientation, and a schedule has been defined for him, and he now goes to school Monday through Thursday from 2:50 until 6:50 p.m. Because of House Bill 2016, we are able to fund that responsible adult through radio cab safe transportation that picks him up every day, will deliver him to school, and be waiting to pick him up at 6:50 and take him home. He has a transition specialist that works with him and touches base with him at least three times a week, and I can tell you why I was meeting with his transition specialist today in my office. David called twice, his mother called three times, and the goal, of course, was to make sure that transportation was in place, because if David didn't attend school today, he would be found in violation of his release and would be back at juvenile detention. So I am pleased to be in front of this committee today. And I, instead of talking about David as another statistic of that 35% that's going to drop out, David only has one credit to his name at this point. But it's my goal that because of this funding and this opportunity and the mentorship that he can receive, that David will find success in completing his education and have positive secondary outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay, and we're going to have a moment. We still have two more groups to go, so.
Okay. And this is our last.
Thank you, sir.
Please. Chair Daugherty, committee, my name is Tony Hobson, President and CEO of Self Enhancement, Inc. What I want to do quickly is to try to connect this back to some of the information that you heard earlier. It's kind of like, why are we doing this? What does it have to do with the other educational policies and directions that we're headed? In doing that, let me remind you, 3 years ago, we had the worst graduation rates in the nation. Today, we're third from the bottom. Why? Because we can't educate poor kids, kids of color, kids with disabilities very well. Kids of color are disproportionately suspended from school, expelled from school, don't graduate, don't go to college, and disproportionately go to jail. The recommendations from the governor's panel suggest that we can better train our teachers and provide mentors for our teachers. But the panel clearly stated that our teachers need to do better with students of color, low-income students, and English learners. The education plan that you heard a little bit about earlier, and they didn't go into all of the detail, but plan recently presented by the Department of Education suggested that we should hire maybe 20 coaches to cover 350 schools with absenteeism. Representative Wilson, you asked a question about that. A little skeptical about those coaches. Well, if in fact we need more folks of color, the question would be, who are those coaches? What kind of background do they have, and do they represent some of the folks that they would actually be servicing? Based on the school attendance audit, that some of the success Scott Perry had at Hillsborough and West Albany High Schools is where some of this comes from. I had the opportunity to talk to Susie Osborne, principal at West Albany, about whether or not some of that's actually working for her. And she spoke very highly of the attendance audit as a place to start, but she quickly said that it's helped them improve their attendance to a degree. But the fact is that there are many students that aren't at the school that a attendance audit is not going to speak to, because you're not at home, you're not in the communities. So when we start talking about solutions, I look at this from an internal and external standpoint. Internally, there are some things that schools can do: equity, culturally specific and responsive teaching, trauma-informed practices, restorative practices. We can do that within the schools to make a difference. The issue for many of our kids has nothing to do with school. It's at home and it's in the community. When we talk about that, we're talking about external. Schools can't get that done. Community-based programs can. We can do the work with the whole child and the family, provide family engagement, family supports, family preparedness, and provide the caring adults that kids need. Really, this is about a holistic approach. It's about a partnership between schools and communities to provide a holistic approach to kids. The efforts by the African American Student Success Plan is in partnership with schools to provide what schools can't provide, and together I think we can get this done. Partnerships internal and external. Give you a quick example of how this works for us. We provided direct services to Jefferson High School, your only predominantly African American high school in the entire state of Oregon. Achievement gap, all of those issues. 5 years ago, we went into that school site. They had a graduation rate of 55%. In 5 years, we moved that up to 81%. The cohort of students that opted into our program graduated at a 91%. That's unparalleled anywhere else in this state, and quite frankly, unparalleled in most places across this entire nation. But that's what we can do in partnerships together. We will replicate that program through this grant at both Park Rose High School and Grant High School. The governor has identified a graduation equity fund, at least that's what she's proposing, to expand and scale up what works for those students most at risk of not graduating from high school. Hopefully, if that goes forward, we could look at what we're doing here as an example and look at some of the successes to then scale them up. After 35 years of successfully serving our most vulnerable youth with data that clearly supports that success, we should not be asking the question of what to do about graduation rates in Oregon. We should be asking ourselves why we refuse to support what we already know works in Oregon. This goes back to your question, Representative Barreto. You talked about things that are happening in other states. We already know all we need to know to educate all kids in Oregon. There are many of us that are extremely successful at that. We've been graduating kids at a 97% clip for 2 decades. We know how to do this. We just need the resources to support it. And we are happy that some of those resources are not coming this direction. Representative Springer, you asked the question, what's different? What's different is that there are some money now being supporting culturally specific services. The biggest difference is not what we're going to do. What has to change is who does it and how we do it. If we can put a little bit more time on those two things, not the what, but the who and the how, we can put a serious dent in the graduation rates here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You guys do a fan. You know, I think this is just a good example. When you put private and public together,
yes,
you can do lots of things, and you guys have been doing it for years. So anyway,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can we have two more. Real quick?
We have two more groups we have to go. One of them is yours. Real quickly, 42 seconds.
Okay. So thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, sorry. When Speaker Kotek and I got together and did this piece of legislation, we had some pretty hefty expectations. And I just want to say this is amazing work. You've done a fantastic job. Keep it up. I think you've exceeded many of those. So thank you for
thank
all
you
the work that
much.
You've done.
I just have to thank these two and the rest of the team, if you don't mind. Tony knows how much I appreciate the work that you've done, and Lakeisha, you managed to put this together. This is really exactly the direction we wanted to see this to go, and we just need to, as you said, we need to make sure that we provide the resources to do it. So, and since SEI happens to be in my district,
absolutely,
I want to make sure that I at least say something. Thank you.
Well, as I say, appreciate you know, that. Being a former high school teacher, sometimes it takes one person.
Thank you very much
for all of your work and your help on this. Okay, Teresa Bowman, please, talking about geography. And we're supposed to be out of here by about 4:30, so 10-ish, 15-ish. And then we'll have safe routes to schools.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Bowman. I'm a professor of geography at Portland State University, and within that department, I run the Center for Geography Education in Oregon. My colleague at Western Oregon, Ken Carano, is the co-director. He was invited here today by Representative Hack to talk about what we do, our mission, and our activities. He, unfortunately, like most of the professors throughout the state today, are doing grades. It's due this afternoon at 4.
Oh. Okay.
I got finished early. So, the Center for Geography Education in Oregon was founded in 1986. It is one of 51 alliances founded by National Geographic Society because they felt that they needed to put their money where their mouth was. They do a lot of funding of research, but very little in geography education. So they asked each state to form an alliance of teachers to improve geography education in the states. We were one of the first 4 to be formed. We are still at one of the national alliances. We simply changed our name. What do we do? We do professional development for K-12 teachers. We do instructional materials, all of which are on our website, free and available to the public. They include atlases, which you'll see in a moment, and model lessons and that sort of thing. We do community outreach. Professor Representative Barreto, you referred to families earlier. One of our key outreach activities is family geography nights throughout the state. And we do advocacy at the national level and at the state and local level for geography education. Why do we do it? A Roper report initiated by National Geographic in 2006 showed that only 37% of young Americans can find Iraq on a map. This despite the fact that we've been there since 2003. 20% of young Americans think Sudan is in Asia. 48% of young Americans believe the majority population in India is Muslim. It's Hindu by a landslide. And half of young Americans can't find New York State on a map, even though they've probably seen many, many, many episodes of Law and Order. So we set out to try and improve that situation. We're funded by a variety of private foundations, primarily National Geographic Society and the Gray Family Foundation, and we have a range of partnerships with national, state, and local organizations to improve geography education. Our main activities are doing workshops and institutes for professional development for teachers. We do an annual conference every year, our GeoFest, which is open and free to teachers around the state. We do Atlas workshops because we found in visiting classrooms that most classrooms don't have maps on the wall. Many of the classrooms have maps that are out of date. I can't tell you the number of classrooms I've walked in where the map still has the Soviet Union on it. And teachers have not been taught about maps. Maps is the language of geography. It's a language you have to learn. And so even if they have a map on the wall, they often do not know how to use that map. So we teach them how to use atlases and how to use maps in instruction across the disciplines, primarily geography, but we'll work with anyone. We do summer institutes. If a teacher is going to teach about the world, wouldn't it be great if the teacher had seen some of the world? 2 years ago, we took teachers across Siberia on the Siberian Express from Moscow to Beijing. One of the teachers had never been on a plane, never been on a train, and never been on a boat prior to that trip. It was a baptism of fire. But now in her classroom, she doesn't just talk about the Bactrian camel, she talks about the Bactrian camel she rode and really engages her students and their interest in exploring the world. We also do family geography nights, as I mentioned. We had three last week. One was in Bandon where the mayor attended, and I encourage you to attend family geography nights if your teachers invite you. They're a lot of fun. These are examples of where we've held our international institutes. We're going to Chile this summer. And this is where we have held workshops, GeoFests, conferences throughout the state. We try and reach every place, and we do everything for free. Teachers do not have to pay a penny for these things, and they get graduate credit for it. We have very generous donors. These are some of our atlases and model lessons. We began with the Student Atlas of Oregon for middle school primarily. Pretty colors, that's important in atlases, but lots of information.
And for middle school students.
And for middle school students, yes. And the identical atlas in Spanish. So we had it translated word for word and is now available in both languages. So students sitting next to each other can see the exact same thing in two languages. The one we just finished this year is the Atlas of Oregon Climate and Climate Change. Part of our attempt to try and put social studies geography, which is how it's taught in K-12, across the curriculum, including earth science, which is basically physical geography. We do maps and posters for classrooms. And we've just initiated a series of activity books to teach teachers how to use maps in the classroom. Again, creating that map literacy at the first level for the teachers so they can then teach their students map literacy. We do posters about the standards. If I'm sure most of you have looked at various educational standards. It's page after page. We put posters together that represent the 18 geography standards and put them in the classrooms for teachers and students to use. And we do it in the form of questions. So, for example, number 13 here, division and control of Earth's surface is something that geographers study. So we put a map of Antarctica and simply ask the question, why do nations claim ownership of the Earth? Geography is about place. That's a core geographic question. We also have giant maps. We now have five giant maps, about 18 by 20 foot in size, which are the opening map in our atlas, the so-called reference map. And these now travel around the state. So imagine this in 18 by 20 foot. In this case, we have a bunch of teachers on it because we were teaching them how to use the map. But it's also fun to see 50 elementary school kids with their socks on mm-hmm. on the map doing various elementary school kid things. Those are traveling around the states. Teachers use them in classrooms, and we use them in various outreach activities. Our family geography nights, we had over 30 throughout the state this year with over 3,000 participants. And what we're trying to do is engage not just the students, but the parents. In most of these family geography nights, we make sure every family gets a map of the world. We encourage them to put it up next to the TV so that every time a state or a country is named, they can run to the map and say, there it is.
There it is.
So that they won't, as one of my students recently
I
thought,
like that.
Believe that Brazil is in Europe. We do participate in Department of Education committees and in national committees. This is part of our advocacy outreach. In particular, we work on standards to make sure that the standards address all the geography issues. We're very fortunate to have had a lot of our teachers receive awards. I won't go through detail, but they've received mapping awards, community partnership awards, distinguished mentor awards, 30 distinguished teaching awards, and National Excellence in Media Award for our map, our atlas set. And finally, we received lots of awards from the Oregon Council for Social Studies, the Association of American Geographers, and the National Council for Social Studies. Our teachers work hard and they do good work. We're very proud of them. Our partnerships across the United States and around the globe include a variety of cultural organizations. The Turkish Cultural Organization, because we were in Turkey and they asked us about geography education in the United States. So we were on Turkish television. Not sure how much that achieved, but it was fun. Domestic government agencies, BLM, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, et cetera. State and local agencies in Oregon, such as Portland Water Bureau. Various universities throughout Oregon, plus universities throughout the world, including University of Bangor, British Columbia, Botswana, Cornell, etc. And we work with a number of nonprofits. Festival of Nations, for example, in Portland, invited us to bring one of our big maps to the celebration this year. It was a horrible rainy day, but the map withstood it. Why do we do what we do? Geography is referred to by many of us as the poor stepchild in pre-K-12. It's not tested. I'm not advocating testing, but because it's not tested, it's ignored.
Yep.
It's not taught. Too often it's believed to be embedded in something else, usually history. Several of the teachers that I was working with last week told me that in 1 week, and these are the social studies teachers, in 1 week they're able to dedicate maybe 20 minutes to geography. And finally, social studies teachers themselves are poorly trained in geography because it's not tested, it's not taught. Why should they take geography courses? So we're there to improve their geography knowledge and to give them the tools, free globes, free atlases, free maps, so that they can teach geography in the classroom. And if we teach them, we believe their students will learn. National Geographic has done the research on that, and they have shown that students who are taught by alliance-educated programs do better on the NAEP test, significantly better than students not taught by alliance teachers. And that's across the United States. It's not just us. We believe in stealth geography. If we can't get a course that's called geography, we will get geography into other disciplines. We recently posted on our free website a bunch of lesson plans about math and geography. We took teachers to the Civil War sites in the East Coast, and we forbade the use of the word history. They had to think geographically throughout the entire trip. And they came back saying they had a whole new perspective on how that war had progressed. We are the mother discipline. This is in your handout. It shows how we're connected to all the other disciplines. This helps us do stealth geography. We can sneak it in just about anywhere. But if we had a geography course, it would also tie all these things together for students. So that's the way we'd like to think of it. And a reminder that geography in K-12 schools is a casualty of time.
We used to have a semester of geography.
Pardon me?
We used to have geography as an elective when I taught. So.
Well, AP geography has now been offered, and it's the fastest growing AP course in the nation. Okay. And they're now thinking about offering an AP course in geographic information systems. Okay. Mapping is the geography is language. GIS is its modern language. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a huge factor in the job sector.
Okay.
Third fastest growing job sector.
Any questions, comments? Okay. Oh, excuse me, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just a brief shameless plug. I've participated in countless family geography nights at one of my schools that's actually on your map. And, of course, there's benefits to geography, but it was an event that I saw more parents show up to than the majority of events. And I got to tell you, that huge map, I've been on it. That thing is just super cool.
The giant map is great.
Yeah. That is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a super map in the town hall of Linz, Germany, a couple of months ago, and it was just the whole entire first floor was nothing but a map of the city of Linz. It was really cool.
Well, the students love it. It really, they just adore that map.
Okay, any other questions, comments?
I'm going to say thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it and for all the work that you do.
Thank you.
Yes, no, I was one of those horrible teachers that, in for history, when we were talking about something on a test, they either had to draw or describe where the Mississippi River is, where this was, where that was, and they didn't like it. So, anyway. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, go forth and be geographers.
Thank you. Thank you. Just do well on geography on Jeopardy. Yes. Okay, finally we have the Safe Routes to Schools. And we have about 15-ish. 20 minutes? Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Christina Bodemer. I'm the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. And I'm here today with my colleagues from the For Every Kid Coalition to talk to you about safe routes to school. For the first time in decades, children are being born with a shorter life expectancy than their parents. In the face of childhood obesity rates that have tripled in the last four decades, physical activity has declined, and it's time to look for some solutions. Given the ongoing challenges of curtailing the childhood obesity epidemic, the American Heart Association is focused on finding opportunities to create healthier, more active communities where the healthy choice to walk or bike can be made the easy and safe choice. Since 1969, the U.S. has seen a decline from nearly 50% of students regularly walking to school to only 13% in 2009. Even though we know that when kids walk a mile to and from school, they're meeting two-thirds of the recommended amount of daily exercise. Nearly 65% of adolescents these days do not get the recommended amount of physical activity. And individuals with sedentary lifestyles are at an increased risk for heart attack, stroke, and other chronic diseases like diabetes. So, although we're working to collect data for a map of the entire state, this is an example of some of the work that's been done for the Portland metro area to serve it as an example of the consequences of health disparities. The dots are all schools. The green dots are schools where 50% or more students receive free or reduced lunch. The shades of purple indicate the level of type 2 diabetes in that general population. So it's easy to see in a small subsection of the population, the direct correlation between type 2 diabetes and Title I schools. The health disparities in active transportation is a big problem and often feeds into other challenges like chronic absenteeism. Children who have the ability to safely get themselves to school are less likely to miss class due to a transportation challenge. So I'm going to pass it off to my colleague, Leanne.
This is also a really good example of geography and data and GIS. Use of GIS and how transportation and health people use it, too. It's great. I'm Leanne Ferguson, and I'm the Safe Routes to School Director with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, soon to be the Street Trust, and a leader in the For Every Kid Coalition. I'd like to start with a quick survey. How many of you walked or biked to school as a kid? Yeah, I actually didn't, but my dad did. He walked to school barefoot, carrying his brother through the snow, uphill
both ways. I did walk uphill both ways in the snow.
Yes, exactly. He was from Oklahoma, too. I was like, what?
Me too.
So, over the past 50 years, walking and biking to school has drastically decreased due to many things like increasing population and increasingly fast traffic. And today, we'll focus on safety. Safe Routes to School is a proven program that can increase walking and biking to schools and the health and safety of kids, grandparents, parents, and neighbors, and increase the options for kids to get to school safely and ready to learn. Oh, man. That's what I meant to say over this slide. This is Safe Routes to School, enabling and encouraging kids to walk, bicycle, and access transit to school. So Safe Routes to School is an incorporation of six E's. It incorporates education, like bicycle and pedestrian safety training, encouragement, as in schools celebrating during Walk and Bike to School Day, engineering, like street improvements, like sidewalks and safe crossings that would make it safe for these kids out in front of Linwood Elementary to cross over Linwood Avenue to get to school. Enforcement, as in partnering with local police and resource officers to address street safety and neighborhood safety needs. And evaluation and equity, like implementing programs that work and prioritizing schools that need it most, like Title I schools. So when the six components are all together, Safe Routes to School increases the number of kids walking and biking to school. The blue line at the top shows a steady increase in walking and biking to school at schools that have Safe Routes to School programs, taken from parent survey data of our longest running Safe Routes to School program in Oregon. Actually, I don't know. It might be a toss-up between Eugene and Portland, but this is some data from the Portland area from parent surveys. So in Oregon, we have dwindling levels of dedicated funding, even as the desire to walk and bike and access transit to school grows. The program started in 2006 when the federal government dedicated transportation funding for Safe Routes to School, which was when most of the programs that are in Oregon started. The dedication ended in 2013, but the funding still comes to Oregon. It's just not dedicated to Safe Routes to School anymore, so it doesn't really go to Safe Routes to School projects. There's currently very little transportation funding available to help support youth, schools, and neighborhoods as they work to build an active and healthy and safe community. But even with our limited funding, there have been so many successes just even in this past year. Safe Routes to School education programs proved successful in many neighborhoods as the number of students walking and biking to school is on a steady increase. Just ask Liz from Tigard, who saw full bike racks at the Tigard Middle School for the first time this year during their first year of the first year of a Safe Routes to School program in Tigard. There are also examples of small projects that make it safe for schools that have served neighborhoods in places like Brookings and Beaverton. In Hood River, a project installed a curb, gutter sidewalk, 20 ADA ramps, 14 crosswalks, and bike lanes in front of Hood River Middle School. This project serves over 500 students and staff. But I'd like to introduce you to Sarah to explain a little bit more about Safe Routes to School using examples in her community.
Hi, my name is Sarah Mazey, and I'm the brand new 1 week Safe Routes to School coordinator in the Eugene 4J district. I'm in the transportation department, and I'll be working closely with the Springfield School District and the Eugene Bethel School District, as well as the Lane Transit District. And you can see my daughter there looking a little squished, actually. But that's on our walk to school, and I feel really passionately about this, in part because of my experience with her. We're really lucky that her route to school doesn't have sidewalks, but there's not a lot of cars, so we can walk to school, and it feels like every morning when we step out the door, the struggles of getting dressed and toothbrushing just drop away, and we have this time of connecting with each other. And by the time I drop her off, her brain's active, and she's gotten some of her wiggles out. She's ready to learn. And I know that she's creating this healthy habit that for the rest of her life, she'll know how to get places using her body. And we're not contributing to climate change through her commute, and we're not contributing to, you know, potential traffic crashes in the parking lot. And that feels really good. But it's not something that all students have in Oregon and all families have. So another story, and then I'll tell you more details about one of our programs. Last week, Leanne was actually down in Eugene, and we had a forum where we heard from some parents and community members why they care about Safe Routes to School. And one woman told us a story of leading a walking school bus, one of our programs, where she walks to school and picks up other kids along the way, along with her kid. And there's a little boy who has autism that started participating in their group, and she was really impressed by how able he was to focus on their walk, and he was doing great. And she said, moreover, she had heard that in school he was actually having greater success in school since he started participating in this walking school bus. So that's just one of our programs. I'm not able to talk about all of these in detail, but I just want to show, I'll give you a moment to read it. These are all the things we're doing, or some of them. We are lucky that we're able to implement all six E's in the Eugene and Springfield area, where a lot of school districts aren't able to do all six or maybe even any. But we've got a long-standing program in that area, and we have had sufficient funding to implement a lot of programming at many schools, but not all. So one of the programs that is most impressive and that I'm really excited about working on is the education program. And it started with two schools, bike safety education programs in two schools with one fleet of 40 bikes. And at this point, we're actually serving 70% of our students. Sixth graders get a 9-hour curriculum on bike safety education. And we have three fleets of 40 bikes each. And they actually were manufactured, two of them were manufactured by Bike Friday, which is based in Eugene and now is making bike fleets for schools across the country after their pilot with us. But this is a really key program because it's basically these kids' first driver's ed. You know, they're learning how to be safe users of the streets. Our second and third graders, 50% of them at this point, are getting pedestrian safety education classes. And that's a 2-hour class. Both of those programs are in school hours. The bike safety education is in PE time, and the second grade class is not part of their PE. It's part of their regular school hours.
Go ahead.
So those are fantastic, but we want to be reaching all of our kids, not just half of the second and third graders and 70% of the sixth graders. And we're far ahead of a lot of other school districts. And we really need 12,000 students in Oregon right now are receiving bike safety education. And we need to get this out to all of our students. We also have significant infrastructure needs. We've found that in the Eugene Springfield area that it could cost up to $1 million per school to actually meet the infrastructure needs for creating a safe route to school that's on-site improvements and the off-site improvements on the routes to school that students would most typically use for biking and walking. So you can see that's significant. So I'll just close by saying that in order to bring safe routes to school for every kid, we really need your help expanding the Safe Routes to School program. And this is, I see it as a great opportunity because we know what, we have the tools to make the changes and achieve all the benefits that we've heard about. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions after.
Thank you. Representative
Spear. We're going to do a little bit of a scene change.
Okay, and then we've got about four minutes.
I think I want to ask this lady a question right here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, great program. I've heard about it in handful of the schools in my house district. I have five different school districts. However, the majority of my district and many parts of Oregon are rural.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can't do this. So, is there any effort, and is it wise to make an effort in the rural areas? My son never walked to school one day in his life, and I never had any intention of him doing it because it was 5 miles, no shoulder, deep ditches. So it just didn't apply. Now, that was our choice to live there, and it far outweighed all the benefits, far outweighed that. How we talk about equity a lot. How are we looking at this through an equity lens across the state for all of our students when in some areas it maybe just doesn't make sense?
Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, we're really focusing on about the 1 mile radius outside of school. That's sort of the radius that we think that most students would be able to walk or bike to school. A little bit further if kids are on a bike, but for rural areas, we know it'll work. In some areas, we know it. I mean, I don't know if we would, if there would be, if it would be possible to make it safe for kids within a 5 mile radius to walk to school. So we're really focusing on that 1 mile radius, and that's where we're getting most of our needs from. In many of the rural schools, there are students within the 1 mile radius that are trying to get to school. And I think that we can do some small improvements in those areas as well that would make it safer for not only children, but parents and neighbors, anybody who wants to access the facilities at the school where there's a park. Oftentimes there's a
food pantry. Oftentimes there's continuing education classes for parents. So having all of those resources accessible to the community by walking and biking if they're close enough to do so. We also think that education is important across the board, and doing things like creating traffic gardens, which is like a park that looks like a street and an intersection, so that even our students across the state are learning how to navigate roads. That education is something that we can do for all students.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So,
With that, and then we'll have the young lady finish.
On one of your slides here, I'm looking at in Oregon, most safe routes to school programs are funded through local and regional governments. So, a very, very brief list of two of those regional governments, and ODOT money. So there's no ODE money here. It's
correct.
ODOT. And then what would regional governments be?
I'm going to back up a little bit to say that occasionally we have been getting some ODE funding kind of through match. If Safe Routes to School coordinator in the Springfield School District, where half of that person is funded through Oregon Department of Transportation funding, and she's part of the the pupil transportation department. So the other half is funded through ODE, and that job incorporates pupil transportation as well as some safe routes to school from the Oregon Department of Transportation. So there's a little bit of overlap just within the staffing. But for the regional funding, most of that comes from the same federal transportation dollars that come to the state. They go to regional metropolitan planning organizations. Half goes to the MPOs and half goes to Oregon Department of Transportation. So some of those MPOs are using that transportation funding to fund safe routes to school programs. We're seeing that in the Portland metro area. We're also seeing it in the Eugene area and in Bend as well.
Okay, Representative McLean.
Well, I think your program sounds like a fantastic goal and fantastic programs that you've been able to create. But equity is a big issue. Rather than what Representative Springer was talking about, rural versus urban, I'm just talking about access to those funds and maybe education on how to apply for those funds.
Yes.
I know of a Title I school in the city of Hillsboro that has no buses. They don't get a choice. They walk.
Right.
And they're coming to school wet. And they're coming to school sometimes not able to concentrate because their feet are wet and they don't have any other support, any other way to go. And we have a lot of rain and or weather that is not necessarily conducive of certain ages walking anywhere, including mine. But it's a situation where I want to understand your program right now. You're asking for money. Are you asking for us to match money for federal money? Are you asking for us to put more money in ODOT? Are you just telling us this is a nice idea?
We are working to expand Oregon's Safe Routes to School program. But we're looking at transportation dollars to reach more students within the current structure of Safe Routes to School, but create within that structure elevation of Title I schools and a technical service to help those schools provide those schools assistance to apply for transportation funding, because we know that's different than the other pots of funding that districts are applying for.
Just ask you to make an appointment with my office and we can talk more.
Wonderful. I'm going to turn it over now to our guests from Hallman Elementary School, Principal Jessica Brendan and Maria.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Maria. And I am a fifth grader student at Hallman Elementary. I'm here to tell you about my experience getting to and from school. My sister and I walk to school. The bus doesn't pick us up because I live too close to the school. Often I don't feel safe walking to and from school. I've been threatened, chased, watched, and I feel scared when these things happen. One day when I was walking to school with my sister, a white car was coming our way. A man rolled down his window and threatened us that we are going to die. We started running and didn't stop until we got to school. After school was over, we went back home and the same car was in front of our apartment. The man was standing there looking at us. I showed my sister and she said, "Let's start running." I said no, because he was close to our apartment. I said we ran up to a friend with my older sister. And she asked if we wanted her to take us home. We said yes. When we were close to our house, the man got inside his car really fast and went away really fast. I felt scared. I wish there was more safe choices for me to get to school.
Okay, thank you, Maria.
My name is Jessica Brendan, and I'm the principal of Holman Elementary. I'm grateful to Maria for sharing her story and to you for providing us the opportunity to be here today. Unfortunately, her story is not unique. Holman is situated in the Northgate community. A drive through the community won't look much different than other communities around Salem. Just beneath the surface, however, are indicators of greater challenges. The reported crime in the area is double that of most other areas in town and triple of a lot. The rest goes unreported because our residents have deep and conflicted views of the police and how they respond when someone calls 911. Also, new graffiti can be found daily. Rather, it's tagging, a way for gangs to indicate their territory. In the area of academics, our students come to us in kindergarten with less than half of the early reading knowledge of the next higher achieving school. Our incoming kindergartners know 2.67% of the information we expect them to have, like letter names and recognizing numbers. We have the highest rate of students eligible for free and reduced lunch prices in Salem-Keizer School District of 95%. As a school at the center of this neighborhood activity, many of our community members feel it is Holman's responsibility to fix all of these problems. The staff at Holman agrees that we are the place to begin the transformation of our community. We also lack the resources and capacity to create sustainable, consistent systems for our community, since our resources primarily need to be focused on what happens inside the school. Our parents have begun the work to coordinate supervision for students who must walk through Northgate Park on the way home. Our community organization, CAPES, has begun to give hope by offering connections and resources to turn the park and the community into a safe place for families. Just Walk Salem-Keizer has begun the process of helping residents understand that they are the ones who can take back their community by partnering with us to create walking groups for parents and teachers. With a funded Safe Routes to School initiative, we would have the resources to sustain these programs and carry them out with fidelity. With a funded Safe Routes to School initiative, we could create a walking school bus or have safe, approved, and recognizable volunteers on every street corner to assure Holman students have safe passage to and from school every day. A funded Safe Routes to School initiative will give feet to grassroots plans to get students to and from school safely along the way, building a more robust network of community connections. A funded Safe Routes to School initiative will positively impact attendance, learning, and community connections. With a funded Safe Routes to School initiative, the Northgate community would be set on a path to believing in themselves again. And we are here to help transform a community that doesn't believe in itself. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any quick questions?
I appreciate your answer because I was confused. It just looked like a program that was put together and it was ready to go, and then I didn't understand if you were asking statewide. I've gone on record saying that I'm trying to get transportation money for safe, you know, for the package. And so that's why I want you to make an appointment. But my point is access and equity. And the fact that whatever program or whatever funds has to be able to be spread across all needs. And there was an example of a really important need here today. Mm-hmm. So, but it just sounds, you know, like we need more details.
You're sort of hitting on what our opportunity is. Our opportunity is to sort of take this great base that we have of a small Safe Routes to School program, which is currently funded at $500,000 a year at the Oregon Department of Transportation, and we have the opportunity to take that and expand it, and be able to reach more students, and be able to do more community programs to get children to school safely, as well as fix the safety needs on the street level, and run programs
programs that can help communities work through whatever issue it is. We believe that this is a community effort, and transportation and education, and it all works together to create these communities for these kids. So. So in the coming months, you guys will have the opportunity to talk through the transportation package and how. And I encourage you to think about how Safe Routes to School fits into that package, so that students like Maria and the students at Linwood Elementary can have two separate issues, but that we can address them through one program.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Okay, Maria, thank you for telling us your story. We really appreciate it. You've been very brave to come up here. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearings. We have gotten no requests for Education Committee bills, so we don't have to deal with that. And the last thing, I would like to say goodbye to Mr. Frederick, Representative Frederick, who is leaving us to go to the other side.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but we appreciate all of the input and the help that you've given us. Thank you very much.
There's one of us, one of our committee members, who's been to the other side and come back, so.
No.
No, weren't you a senator as well? Oh, I thought you were a senator.
No, so anyway.
Well, I've had a cleaner lifestyle.
With that, I adjourn the House Committee.
Set myself up for that.
With that, I adjourn the House Committee.